It's a really weird one, isn't it? Because I feel like, you know, when I started it, I won't say who, but lots of like the bigger producer and engineer friends of mine are like, why are you doing this? How are you going to make any money out of it? And I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm ever going to make any money out of it, but it seems like the right thing to do.
That's Warren Hewert, the man that runs the great YouTube channel, Produce Like a Pro. I'm Jamie Green, and this is Trading.
I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. Oh, yeah.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to another edition of Trading Fours. I'm your host, Jamie Green. I hope you're doing well and hanging in there. And for today, we've got Warren Hewert, who is an amazing producer, an engineer, and mixologist of music, anyway, mixologist. He's got this really cool website, producelikeapro.com. It's down the show links, and he does these really interesting and prolific YouTube videos all about music and production. And Warren's job, what Warren wants to see is people who are doing home recording to do it well and make it sound great and have a good time while they're doing it. So Warren got on my radar a couple different ways. First of all, he got Roger Joseph Manning Jr. to come in and go track by track on both Jellyfish albums. And if you're a Jellyfish nerd like me, that was just like heaven. And then second, he just recently had on a former guest. Well, I guess Roger's also been a guest on this podcast, but also my buddy Billy Decker, who is a recording engineer and producer out in Nashville. And Warren had him in, and they had a great chat too. So I reached out to Warren, super nice guy. He was really happy to spend some time. And we're going to talk all about what he does, how he does it, and how he wants you to be a part of this community. So if you're into home recording, this episode's for you. So you know what I'm going to say, people. Let's get started. Here's my conversation with Warren Hewert.
Well, you know, you got on my radar, and people are going to laugh. I've been doing the podcast for 2 years, and I've had I joke that I'm filling in my Jellyfish bingo card. because I've had, you know, Jason on and Eric Dover on and Roger Manning on and Tim Smith on. And I think you and I are almost the same age. And that was such a seminal record, the first one and then the second one, too, that you actually got to sit down with Roger and go through track by track. And I was like, holy shit, I've been waiting to hear about this for 3 decades.
Oh, yeah, it was an amazing experience. But carry on. You start me off on that, I'll go on for hours, but carry on.
Well, I just think it's really cool what you're doing. You know, I think getting locked in our houses for 18 months, there's a lot of bad things, but it gave at least me a lot more free time to kind of surf around and see what's going on. And you're prolific. You guys are doing so much every day. It's amazing.
Thank you. We'll think about this recently, and it's come up in a few conversations. If we're about the same age, then we are the good old Generation X. And
yeah, absolutely.
I feel like what's the advantage, an advantage, I should say, not the advantage, but an advantage of being a Generation Xer is like, even though it wasn't my time, I looked to the 60s and the 70s, and I loved the music. And I was more of a child, like a little kid in the late 70s. 80s is when I started to come of age as a teenager. And then, of course, I'm in bands during the 90s and early 2000s. That's basically my life summed up. Okay, thank you. I'll go. No, but that's basically it. But what it was is we were able to sort of connect like all the boomer music of the 60s and the 70s, so all of the music that they love, with the music we're growing up with, the 80s, and there's a lot of good 80s that gets ignored, I'm sure you notice. And then the 90s, you know, we were in our teens and early 20s when, of course, grunge hit. And, you know, so I think that when we're really like we're in bands and stuff like that. And so I think we're blessed as Gen Xers. We're sort of blessed because we can connect all the world together. Jellyfish were one of those bands that connected it all together, didn't they? Because it's early 90s, just before grunge when the first album comes out, at least before grunge hit. grunge obviously existed. And I remember being in England, I'm in bands in the UK with friends of mine, and we're all fans of all the obvious things. Beatles, obviously, all the great bands, XTC, massive fans. All of us were massive fans of XTC, particularly English Settlement and Black Sea. And not to take anything away from Drums and Wires or anything after that, just but those two albums were just so great sounding. I still love listening to them. And then when I was a little tiny kid, I remember hearing like Supertramp on the radio, and of course ELO were huge in England all the way through the 70s and early 80s, so you couldn't avoid hearing ELO. So there, this. And then my dad bought my mum a Beach Boys Greatest Hits record for Christmas when I was a little kid. And I remember my mum used to listen to that. And then this band comes along, Jellyfish. And they're all those bands stuck together, but with a bit of kind of Elvis Costello in there as well. A little bit of punk rock. And that might not seem obvious, but they got punk rock and new wave mixed in with their over-the-top, insane harmonies and incredible musicianship. So it really kind of connected everything for me. And I said this to Roger. I think that Jellyfish's success, because they were just starting to get successful in the UK. They had a top 40 single. I think...
Baby's Coming Back. Was that it? Yeah. What was it?
Yeah, may even have been top 30. I think it was like 23 or something like that. I mean, if you're a top 40 in England, that's a big deal, because you watch Top of the Pops and they count down the top 40. So if you got into that top 40, everybody knew who you were. On a Thursday night, every kid that I knew was watching Top of the Pops, and there's Jellyfish. And it was a big deal. And then, of course, they broke up as they started to get successful. But to cut a long story short, I don't know if it's subconscious or whatever it is, but Britpop, within a year or two, that's kind of explodes, has all those same elements, has a bit more new wave in it, a bit more jam meets Elvis Costello, but all of the massive kind of 60s influences. And I really feel like us as musicians in the UK at the time really like connected all of that together. And I was playing in Britpop-y bands, and my friends were in Britpop bands, and some of them were quite successful, and we all loved Jellyfish. So I think they're a lot more influential. And just without going on for too long.
I know. That's how I am too. So you're fine. Yeah.
Without going for too long, one of the things I like championing, because I know with the really, really big YouTube channels, the thing to do is to just talk about the biggest songs. You know, you can do if I did a video on Comfortably Numb, which maybe I'll do, I know it will get like 500,000 views, like some of my other big songs that I do. And I love Pink Floyd. They're in my top five greatest bands of all time. But I kind of like doing videos on Jellyfish. I like doing videos on Ian Dury and the Blockheads, which, believe it or not, is like hit 130 or 40,000 views. And nobody in America knows who they are.
Right.
But to me, every kid who heard that song was influenced by it. And so many of us could sit down. You could go to a pub now in England and our age group could get together and somebody could go, "Hit me with your rhythm stick, hit me." And everybody would go, "Zutalo, ignibidik, hit me, hit me, hit me." Such an important, you know. So for me, it's like, I know, you know, if I stuck to just doing the big bands and if it was all just about, and I've done some of them, don't get me wrong, but if I only did videos on the Police and Pink Floyd and stuff like that, I know that it would probably grow the channel bigger. But at the same time, we all know that the Velvet Underground and Iggy and the Stooges and Love Forever Changes, I'm getting people going, "I've never heard of them, how can they be influential?" I'm like, because every band that you like
right
in that period references them. You don't have to have sold a million records to be influential. So anyway, look, my long diatribe aside, I mean, that's how I see Jellyfish. They were one of those bands that just, you know, everybody heard and was just like, "That's it. I'm going back. I'm listening to Supertramp again. I've forgotten about Breakfast in America. It's amazing." I mean,
they did 10cc.
10cc, go back and Things We Do for Love. The Things We Do for Love.
So I have a question, since you're the professional, this is what you do.
Oh, yeah.
So
don't call me that.
How is it possible that three guys who have never been in the studio, really, I mean, I'm sure they've done some stuff, but not in a professional studio, not with Albie, not with all that stuff. How did they hit a home run the first time? I mean, that's what I was the most amazed by. Usually it takes bands a couple, two, three, four albums to kind of hit stride. And those guys just out of the gate were just awesome.
Yeah, but I think those two guys in particular, if you ask Roger, I mean, they were sitting in there like working on those songs and demoing them and writing them for quite a long time before Jack Joseph Puig got involved, with them. And obviously he's not credited as the producer, but we all know one of the things that he brought that was incredible was just the sonic,
mm-hmm.
That was one of the things when that album came out, you could tell they were a band that rehearsed. You could tell they were a band that was really into their production, was really into arrangements, was really into, really, really loved that stuff. But they never disappeared up their own butts. They never became...
Right.
You don't listen to a Jenny Fish song and go, oh, my God, I think they're playing the Lydian Phrygian over the blah, blah, blah. It's not bullshit kind of like over-intellectualizing it. It's just built on pure melody and harmony and just a great arrangement of incredible lyrics and a feast of sonics. This world at the moment, we're so caught up on music theory. I almost feel like we're back in the 80s. Yeah. Remember in the 80s when everything was just shred,
oh, yeah.
And the song. Now we're all sort of obsessed with explaining everything away with theory. And yet I've never worked with a musician, any of these that have sold millions and millions of records even thinks that way. That's how you explain it after the fact, but it's not how you create music. It was Mozart that said all music is improvised. You sit there and you play something, unless it's kind of blue and you're literally pigeonholing yourself to a mode or something within a song to solo in, that's not how we think, So I think Jellyfish, they didn't do that. They just wrote from the heart. They obviously loved great production and they reference it and you can hear it, but it never, ever sounds like they copied anybody.
No.
They just absorbed ELO. They absorbed, Out of the Blue. They absorbed Breakfast in America. They absorbed, all the Elvis Costello
Attractions
records.
I hear a little Pet Sounds in them.
Pet Sounds, Rubber Soul, all of that's there, but there's no like... You don't pick it apart and say it's a ripoff of anything. It's just...
No, it's not derivative. You said, it's influenced by, but they take it in their own direction, which is cool. Well, I don't want to make this all about Jellyfish. That's how I became aware of you. And the other thing that's really cool is that my college buddy, the dude I used to hang out with above the Spaghetti Works in Lincoln, Nebraska, and play guitars with and talk music and bullshit with and hang out and talk about girls and stuff, is Billy Decker, who you just had Billy on.
Oh, I love Billy.
Yeah, Billy's one of my close friends, man. We've been friends for 35, 40 years now. So how did he get on your radar? I mean, he's a country guy. So how did he get on your radar?
He's a country guy, but he does a lot of stuff outside of country, doesn't he? He got on my radar, and I think I knew him through Reed Shippam, because I think I was on, this is just going to sound like the most vacuous thing, but it's just, I'm telling you the truth. The truth is I was reading one of Reed's posts and Billy commented and Reed responded. And I was like, Billy Decker, I know that guy, because I remember we were doing an album maybe 8 or 10 years ago, before I launched the YouTube channel and did all this stuff. We were doing an album with this guy from Colorado. And we were talking about potential mixes. And the guy I was working with said, oh, we should use Billy Decker. So I'd done some research on him about 8 or 10 years ago, found his stuff, really liked it. But I think the other guy ended up choosing, I don't know, the singer or whatever chose a different mixer. So he'd been on my radar because I checked out his work and I understood the way he worked. I understood the sounds he got. And then I'd completely forgotten. And then... 6 months or so ago, I see Reed and Billy having a conversation on Instagram in the comments. And so I click on it and I'm like, that's the guy.
Yeah.
And so there it is. It may have been longer than that. Maybe a year ago. I don't remember. But yeah, it's quite a vacuous excuse. But I mean, sometimes that's just kind of how it happens. Somebody jogs your memory.
No, it's so much fun. Bill's got a lot of personality, which I'm sure when you interviewed him, you figured that out pretty quickly. I mean, he's super fun and lighthearted, and he's really good about making jokes about himself, about how he's kind of a schmo with mixing, but he's great at it. I mean, obviously he's done really well with it.
He's great at it. And you're right. He's very self-effacing. He's very modest. You don't think it's an act, you know, a lot of the time. I'm sure, you know, we talk to people and we're like, no, what do you mean?
Especially out where you are, I'm sure. Right.
Yeah.
Well, we're Nebraska boys, you know, the Nebraska guy, we're humble people. We're from humble stock.
Yeah, it's not even so much that, is it? It's just that, you know, because, you know, Produced Like a Pro is very deliberately not called my name. You know what I mean? It's we were talking about this the other day about working, you know, working with professionals, the ones that you always come back to over and over again, are just people that just like this, two of us BSing about music and stuff like that. You know, I as much as I admire some people, I can tell you, if Jack Douglas was sitting here next to us, he'd be having the same conversation. He might be able to say like John Lennon every three lines and tell you a story about John Lennon, or he might be able to tell you about, you know, how he and Steven Tyler did acid, you know, on he's got tons of those stories. But at the end of the day, he's telling you in a just kind of very like matter of fact kind of way. Those are the kind of people I like. I like people you can just be, I suppose, sounds cheesy, but be real with, just sort of be normal around. That's a better way of describing it.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's a good segue to your Produce Like a Pro. So Warren, I'm 53 years old. And when I was in college, I took a recording studio class actually with Billy. It was 16 track physical tape. The world has changed so much in those 30 years, right? Where now everybody can have a DAW system in their house. Everybody can record at home and get a pretty good sound. So from your standpoint, I mean, I think you could have said, oh, I don't want to delve into that. I don't want to help these people. I would rather they came, you know, to people like me and my ilk. But you really have embraced trying to help people be a lot better at doing this at home. So what made you want to do that?
Well, it's a really weird one, isn't it? Because I feel like, you know, when I started it, I won't say who, but lots of like the bigger producer and engineer friends of mine are like, why are you doing this? How are you going to make any money out of it? And I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm ever going to make any money out of it, but it seems like the right thing to do. I think from my perspective, you know, I've told this story in different versions over the years, but it's fun to tell it. So I grew up in a really, really wealthy area, super poor. Not like pretend Facebook, Instagram, you know, poor, but like actual poor. My dad was a painter and a sculptor, and we lived in a two bedroom semi-detached bungalow that was 554 square feet. So
wow.
It was about the size of my recording studio, which is a double car garage behind the house. But we didn't know we were poor. You know what I mean? There was three kids in the two bedroom, one bathroom, and it was just a two bedroom, living room and a kitchen and a bathroom. And we didn't really know or think about it. But one of the things it did is like, I went to really, really nice schools. They were free because they were in the area. But one of the things it did was give me a nice kind of inverted snobbery. So I really like people who work their ass off. And I'm not a big fan of handed to you, you know, and I think that's what it did. You know, when I was a kid and we wanted a guitar, obviously I'm a huge Brian May fan, but my dad and I got together and built a guitar. Now, don't get me wrong. He did 99.999% of it. You know, I just kind of sanded some things and pretended to cut something, and he did all the proper work on it. But there was a combination of two things. Number one, I wanted to be Brian May. And number two, we didn't have any money to buy a proper guitar. And which is probably very similar to Brian himself, very similar kind of motivation. Although I think Brian talks about wanting to make the perfect guitar for himself, which is probably a huge part of it. But I think, again, he didn't grow up with any particular wealth. But there I am in a town and an area and a village, quite frankly, where we were, where you could go over to my friends' houses and they'd be like, Daddy, I'd like a guitar. And their first guitar was like a Les Paul Custom, you know.
Right.
So what it did is it made me, you know, really work harder than everybody else. You know, I'm an engineer and a producer, and I've made lots of nice records that people know. But I'm also played session guitar. I play on most of the records. I also play drums to average level, keyboards to a slightly better than average. You know, I pride myself on trying to be really good at everything, because I sort of came from a place where I was surrounded by people that were, you know, don't about handed everything, because some of these people are still really good friends of mine. But, you know, I had to work very hard to get anywhere. So why did I start the YouTube channel? That's my long answer, is I just wanted to give people that same opportunity. And I also found that having not come up in the studio system and not having any kind of ins through family or best friends, you know, and all that kind of stuff, I felt like, well, my existence, all of this, the SSL, all these, you know, Poltex and Golden Platinum Records, all came from working really hard, not from anything else. And I was like, isn't that kind of what everybody has to do now? Everybody has to do that. Everybody has to find a way. Because, yes, there are schools, but there's very few studios. Mm-hmm. There's very few opportunities to make money in music in all of the traditional ways. Now, don't get me wrong. We could have a whole conversation about, yes, there is ways to make music, money from music. And I really strongly believe that there's more opportunity than in ever for a middle-class thing. It's affected the high level, but it's definitely helped a lot of people make some money. And that's a whole other conversation. But my point is like my experience of the past mirrors where we're at now. So that's why I started the channel. And then the second thing, and probably just as equally important, is I wanted to create my own playground. Hmm. I want a place where, like, if you go inside the Produce Like a Pro Academy, it's a lot of guys and girls like you and me. It's a lot of people that just kind of love music. Maybe they're good at one piece of it. Maybe they're good at multiple pieces of it. Maybe they're learning. Maybe they're not. But there's no hierarchy. No hierarchy. There's no, even when I'm in there chatting away, there's no like, I can't believe, you know, I tease people. We did a live thing the other day and somebody said, I'm shocked that you didn't. I was like, oh my God, you're shocked. It's just like, come on, calm down. This is just like, let's all get together and just help each other. You know, I was teasing the person, but you know what I mean? So that was another thing, is I wanted to create a place where everybody could come together and feel safe and talk about music. And at that time in particular, there wasn't really that many places.
Right.
Also, you know, post-pandemic or during the pandemic, you know, 1,000 YouTube channels have gone up because everybody wants to create a business opportunity. But what I love about what we did 6-7 years ago is there wasn't really a business opportunity. For the first year and a half, we didn't even put an ad on a video. There was no money being made. And I would get in here at 9 a.m. with my original intern, whose name was Connor, and we would get in and we'd film a video until 11 o'clock when the client arrived. He'd drive home, edit it, and put it up the next day. And we would do that 3 to 5 days a week. And that's how we started the first. And we just used to open sessions and talk about compression and EQ and stuff like that. And we built our first 100,000 followers from just doing that. And nobody else was doing that. There was no, we weren't talking about products. We weren't talking about any kind of monetization whatsoever. We were just teaching stuff. And, you know, even now when I talk about like these nice speakers that I'm trying out at the moment that we demoed, we've been demoing, it's still the same philosophy. I still want it to be, you know, that's, people say to me all the time, they're like, is that you engaging? I'm like, yep. And then all my YouTube friends go, why do you engage? It takes so much effort and work. Rah, 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 rah. And I'm like, because I want to build a community. And if I'm like engaging people and answering their questions, firstly, it doesn't actually take that long. So when you don't see somebody engaging their 400 comments, it's really just like, oh, don't be bothered to do that. And I don't want to be that guy.
Yeah.
You know, I want to, that whole chip on my shoulder, that inverted snobbery also involves kind of like doing the things that nobody did for me, you know?
Totally.
When I ask questions, I was just the annoying kid. I don't want to, you know, I'll answer people even when they're trolling me, even though I know their question is just their way of trying to be superior. I'll answer it with an honest answer.
Is that because of your British background where you're just that nice, or you just,
I don't think I'm that nice. I really don't. I just think I'm being honest. You know, I just think it's good to sort of help people, you know?
Sure.
You know, I have a hard time. It's like, maybe it's the British thing. I don't know. But, you know, I've got lots of gold and platinum records. You know, this is a fraction of what we've done. And that's really great. But by me saying that, I want to qualify something, and somebody's listening to this. I have got gold and platinum records by being involved in other people's albums. You'll never hear me say, I have a platinum record or my platinum record.
Right.
It wasn't. That platinum record, there's one that's from The Thrills, and I got that one specifically from them because it was a number one and a big selling record in Ireland, where they're from. And my mother and my mother's family, half my family are Irish. So okay. that meant something to me to get a platinum record from Ireland working with an Irish band. It's their record.
Right.
People bought it because it says The Thrills on it. They didn't buy it because Warren Cure had anything to do with it.
Yeah.
So I think for me, it's really a case of remembering that we are blessed to be on the other side of the glass, to write songs with artists, because without their voices, I'm just a guy writing a song. Nobody cares. If I can write with them and it does well, then I can say, wow, I was involved with somebody else's incredible talent. If I can play guitar on somebody's song and it does well, then I, like I did with James, I can say, wow, I play guitar on a James Blunt hit. It means a lot to me. The Fray, whatever it might be, whatever my involvement was, it's ultimately just the artist. So, I'm not trying to overdo it, but maybe it comes across like that. All I can say is that Produce Like a Pro is not about the ego. It is not about celebrating what a great, incredibly smart person I am. I don't believe that. I believe that, for instance, I've got Academy members that run businesses that are assistant managers in businesses or whatever they do. So they are at a level of professionalism in their chosen field. So why does a white male guy want to say I am just because I'm in any entertainment, I'm more important? That means nothing to me. When we do the masterclasses, I remember the first one we did, we had one of our members, Lem, come to it. I hope you're watching, Lem. And Lem, I think at the time, was running AT&T support. And I don't mean sitting there answering phones. I mean running their whole support.
Right.
So he's he's probably got 20,000 people that's answering to him. I'm making up a number, but you get the point. So that guy is at my level or above. He's achieved something really successful. And I think, just because it's the arts, just because it's glamorous, just because sometimes the paychecks can be big, it's kind of BS. We've got to remember that we're just rolling up our sleeves and working hard at our chosen field. And so, Matt Bougereau, when he first started his podcast called Working Class Audio, I was like, damn, I should have thought of that. I just swore.
Everybody's got a podcast now. I mean, even a schmo like me. I it's really interesting. You're talking, I think one of the word that, to paraphrase, egalitarian, right? This is an egalitarian thing. Having this ability, studios used to be, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of dollars just for some pieces of the studio. And now that you have, Pro Tools and you've got it's not that expensive to do this. And it really kind of levels the playing field, right? That was what your point
was
growing up poor and stuff. So kids that are really good musicians and are really trying to do something, they can make a pretty darn good demo at home.
They can make a master at home.
Yeah, it's amazing. So from your standpoint, because the whole idea of this whole podcast was I kind of wanted to lift the curtain up behind the scenes kind of thing about me. What do you think, what's the number one mistake that people recording at home do? What do they do wrong?
Overthink it.
Okay.
Probably. I mean, trust your ears. I tell this story all the time, and I don't think my father-in-law has ever watched us, but maybe he'll watch this one. So I'm going to embarrass my father-in-law.
Well, I'm in Kansas City, so I doubt it, but okay.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm happy for him to hear this. So my father-in-law goes on a cruise. This is about 5 years ago. So he goes on this cruise. He comes back from the cruise. And he comes to see us, and he's in his hands, he's clutching this CD, and he gives me this CD, and he goes, Warren, this is the crooner on the cruise ship. This is his solo album. I told him that you would listen to it and give him some pointers. So I'm just like, thanks. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I get in the car, and I remember we were in my wife's car, and I remember I put the CD like in, you know, in the, whatever it's called, the center section.
Right.
You know, of course, 3 months go by and I'm not in my wife's car and I'm not listening to the CD. But one day, I can't remember why, but one day I'm using my wife's car. Maybe I had to pick up something because she has a SUV, you know, for the kids and school stuff and transporting things. So maybe I was transporting. I can't remember. But there I am. I'm in my wife's car. And of course, I look down and I'm like, there's that CD that I've been ignoring for at least 3 months, maybe even 4 months. And I was like, I suppose I better put it on, you know. So I begrudgingly put the CD into the CD player. Still had a CD player in the car until it was about 5 years ago. So I put it in. And, of course, it's exactly what you'd expect. It's all completely – it's nice, but it's very oversung. It's very like everything's like super earnest. And it's good, but, you know, it's what you expect to see when you go and see people do covers and like croon and stuff on a cruise ship. Everybody sort of enjoys the over the top kind of thing. And that's what the CD sounded like. So I skip through, I listen to like halves of songs and quarters of songs. And I try to go through the whole song, you know, the CD, like 10 or 15 songs. So get through the CD, I call up my father-in-law, call him up from the car. And I say, hey, I just want to let you know, I listened to the CD of the crooner from the cruise ship. And of course, first thing he says is like, God, I was wondering when you were going to do that. I promised him you were going to listen to it.
Your father-in-law and my father-in-law need to hang out, Warren.
Yeah. I think everybody who's got a father-in-law is laughing at this point because it's not exclusive to my father-in-law. It's just father-in-laws.
And when you're done, I'm going to tell you a really quick, funny father-in-law story, but please finish.
Okay, good. So he's like, well, what did you think of it? And I was like, before I tell you what I think of it, what did you think of it? And he goes, oh, it's horrible. So I said to him, then why did you give it to me to listen to? Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, because you're a professional. So therein lies the problem. When you ask me what's the number one mistake that people in home recording studios environments do, you know, my immediate answer was they don't trust themselves and they overthink it. They don't trust themselves and they overthink it. And that's exactly what my father-in-law does. And it's what every human condition. When somebody sends me something to review, and trust me, I get 200 a day.
Oh, I bet you do.
But what I do is like, I will do it inside of the academy. We have like a review process. We stream songs in there and everybody gets involved and they talk about it. And people in there are really smart and they have great ideas and they critique each other's mixes and it's super positive and people grow really fast. So all of that happens. But when we do it, somebody sends me an email, especially, you know, because I'll do like a paid consultation.
Right.
They'll send me something and I'm sitting there like one-on-one like we're doing now and I'm listening. And I'll say to them, they'll say to me, what do you think? And I was like, and I always do the same thing. I always go, well, what do you think? And they'll be like, I think the low end's really out of control. You know, it's like the bass is really overtaking the kick drum in lots of places. What do you think? And I was like,
right.
I mean, you just said it. The low end's out of control. The bass, it's like they're not trusting. They're like, they're hearing something, but they're thinking maybe they're wrong. And I think one of the things, and it's one of the sort of jokes that I've made on and off, maybe not quite so much recently, but about experts, you know, it's like, I'm not really a big fan of experts because it makes this sort of this belief that there's this class of people that can, you know, like we're joking about, the first can analyze music, therefore that makes them more important because they can analyze it. You know, it's like, but the person who wrote it doesn't think that way. There's right. also tons of people that can listen to music and go, well, you see 3.5K on a snare drum. And yet it's like, well, what about when you listen to it? You know, the best thing a producer, an engineer or a mixer can be, especially a producer, mixer definitely second, definitely engineer third, maybe in that order. But those three elements, the best thing they can do is be in every person.
Isn't that so true?
Yeah.
Because regular people don't listen to music like you do or Billy Decker does or Roger Manning does or whoever. It's a totally different – I'll tell you really quick. My wife, and she likes music, but she's not musical. She's never played an instrument and stuff. And we were, I have a 90s cover band, and I was kind of joking. I said, oh, I should do Cake song, but I don't have a trumpet player. Like, I can't do Cake without a trumpet player. And she was like, what do you mean? I said, Cake, got a trumpet, like every song. I've never noticed that before. Right? So you didn't even notice that.
Yep.
Anyway. Yep. All right. You want to hear my quick father-in-law story?
Tell me your father-in-law story. Ring true.
So you're going to love this. So my father-in-law is like one of those people. He loves to go see live music. He's also not musical at all. And like, you know, just a blues hound and goes around stuff. So he'd been bothering me. He found out that I'd played in college. And he kept wanting me to go to open jams and all. And I was like, I don't like to do that. Like, I want to be prepared. Like, I have a little bit of ego. Like, I want to be prepared. If I'm going to be on a stage, I want, and I hadn't done it for a long time anyway, because my kids were little and you're, you know, busy and exhausted and you don't want to do that. So I finally did a show with my wife's cousin, who's a professional jazz singer. We did a Women in Rock show. Warren, he'd been bothering me for this for like at least 20 years. Like, this has been going on for decades. And we get done. Show was great and stuff. And so he walks up to me and I said, what'd you think? You finally got to hear me play guitar. And he said, I didn't really pay attention to what you're doing. I was just listening to the singer. I was like, well, I'm so glad that you pestered me for 2 decades so you could ignore me when you finally got to hear me. So anyway.
You know, it makes perfect sense. I had a girlfriend come to a show of mine in London, and I think it was at the Mean Fiddler, and it was a big deal for us. It was one of our very first shows, and we were super excited to play the Mean Fiddler. So we're playing it. My girlfriend comes to the show, and it was a guitar, bass, drums, and a girl singer. And occasionally she would play like rhythm and stuff like that. But it was essentially, I was playing bass in this band, and the other guitarist was playing most of the guitar parts, lead and stuff like that. And at the end of the show, I said to her, I said, what did you think? And she said to me, so the other guitar player would just kind of stand there and would barely move. And she goes, but he was doing all the clever stuff with the pedals and playing all the lead parts.
Yeah.
She goes, I really liked you guys, but that guy on the other side of the stage is really boring. You should just get rid of him. And I was like, honey, it doesn't work like that. You can't just like, you know, so there's going to be no guitar in the songs anymore. That's literally what she thought. She just, which also speaks in many different ways of like, you know, when you go and see a band play, it's like, there's more to it than just playing the right noises, you know, mm-hmm. It's like, it really goes back to that first part of the conversation, talking about like analyzing music as one element. There's so much to it, you know, a great lyric, you know, sometimes the recording quality can define it in different ways. You know, when you're talking about like early punk rock and stuff like that, it's kind of good that it's distorted and crappy sounding, and it adds to, it makes it sound more authentic. I mean, there's a reason why we like distorted vocals in tracks. You know, it makes it sound kind of like edgy and exciting, and so much more to music than just one element. Either A, you know, from my perspective, overanalyzing the mix and the instrumentation and the way it's EQ'd and compressed and all that stuff, or overanalyzing the theory behind it or whatever it might be. It's all the sum of the parts. And I think that we have to remember that. And sometimes it's got nothing to do with any of those things, and it just works. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the biggest things I noticed with doing A&R for labels, I worked as an A&R guy for a couple of labels, you know, while still producing and everything. And one of the things that you could tell that made good A&R guys or girls, good A&R people, was the fact that they could suspend all of that stuff and just come away with guttural reactions. And I think the best people in those jobs always just know, again, like we're talking about, when something just connects. But when somebody doesn't like something, that's when they start going, it's because, and they start listing out all these things. But when they like it, they just love it. Yeah. Just connect, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think a good example of that, I had Greg Renoff on, and Greg wrote with Ted Templeman, Ted Templeman's autobiography. I don't know. Have you read this book?
Not yet.
You really get a kick out of it. Because, you know, part of the Ted Templeman story is like, you know, I don't know how many people had passed on Van Halen. And Ted Templeman came down and he's like, holy shit, that guy right there. Like, that's it. Like, you know, to him, it was like, he didn't care that, you know, that Roth was Roth. He didn't care about, like, he just said, he's like, this is like the, you know, the Charlie Parker of this generation, right? He didn't overthink it. I forgot how many people passed. You know, I know they did the demo with Kiss and didn't go anywhere.
Regine, yep.
Yeah, it's hard, I think, to get objective when you've been doing something for a long time, right? To step back and put aside all the things that you have kind of accumulated and be able to actually objectively listen to something without preconceived notions, right? That's a hard thing to do.
Yeah, I knew Eddie, but I never talked to him about some of that stuff. I mean, he was very, very generous with us, like incredibly generous with us. He gave me one of his amps. I have a 5150 up there, which is one of his. He gave me three guitars. One he signed to my son was one of his personal guitars, and then he gave us two others, which I gave to guys that were working with us when we worked on stuff with him. And he was a real, real sweet, incredible guy. I'll tell you one thing about Eddie that really kind of, I think, in my humble estimation, is why Eddie Van Halen was Eddie Van Halen. It was the first time I ever met him. He doesn't live very far from here. I drove to his house, about 5 minutes away, 10 minutes away. I drove there and pull up into the driveway, let through the gates, and then I park up by the studio and on the property. And he walks out. And he comes up, and it was a hugger. He kind of give you a big hug. He was really funny. He goes, "Have I met you before?" And I was like, "Trust me, if I met you before, I would have remembered." You know what I mean? I just like the way he said that. You know? Like, "I met you before. Like, I feel like I know you." You know? And I was like, "No." Mm-hmm. But this to me sums him up. If you want to take one little piece from this interview, is I walk into the studio and there's a couch, and he sort of says, "You know, sit down." And I sit down, where I sit, there's like a dent where he'd been sitting, and beside it was the guitar. And of course, I was like, "May I?" And I pick up the guitar, and the guitar was warm. And I just remember, I can teary-eye thinking about it. I'm like, that's why Eddie frickin' Van Halen was Eddie frickin' Van Halen. That he was sitting there and been playing guitar for hours until the moment I arrived. And it's like warm and a little bit sweaty. And that's why Eddie Van Halen was Eddie Van Halen. And people used to say to me, "Oh, yeah, he's a hermit." And I was like, "What are you talking about? You mean he stays at home in his studio and plays music all day? That's not a hermit. That's a guy getting to do what he loves, you know?"
Absolutely.
So there's a reason why he was so incredible. I don't know anything about the backstory of how they got signed or anything like that. But for me, you know, the reason why Van Halen were Van Halen was because of that, because of the work ethic. He kicked down walls, kicked down barriers, and just created, something absolutely insane.
Yeah. And the only thing I'll add to that, and then I'll wrap up so you can make money as opposed to, I really appreciate the time. His rhythm playing is way underrated. Yep. He just, you could tell, you could tell he started on drums. I mean, his rhythm is just impeccable. His timing is just impeccable. And their songwriting, you have to write, Van Halen was one of those bands. Yeah. All the guys love them, but all the women love them too. They wrote great songs. I mean, if you can write a great song, you can do gymnastics all you want, but if the song sucks, I don't care how much guitar gymnastics you do. Nobody cares. So anyway, that was that. So to wrap up, obviously I'll put in the show notes the link to your website so people can find you and stuff. So Warren, what's up for 20? I know it's almost 2022. It's hard to believe. It actually feels like fall today in Kansas City, finally. What's going on? What do you got going?
More of the same and new stuff. One of the things that's really important to me is to build community. Obviously we already have an amazing community, and, sales pitch, go check out producelikeapro.com. Please sign up. I mean, the site's really, really doing well. It's growing rapidly. And we do lots of different things. Honestly, Jamie, I just like doing 1,000 things. I mean, at the moment, I just cut vocals yesterday with Arnell, from Journey.
Yeah,
So he came down and sung with Mark Martel, who did a lot of the vocals in the Queen movie and everything. And so Arnell and Mark it's a Mark song, but Arnell's done a guest on it. I just dropped in some strings by the wonderful Ollie Krauss, and just got some strings, So I'm doing part of Mark's album. He's doing a lot of it on his own, and I'm doing additional tracks. We did a song with Jared James Nichols playing guitar, who I produced the first two albums for as well, and co-wrote the songs on the first couple of albums, and with Mark as well. So Jared's playing on that. We have a song with Joe Bonamassa playing on it. We're doing that. So I'm doing this. I'm also mixing an artist, my friend Rich Ross, has sent me. And I'm doing Produce Like a Pro and everything else. I mean,
yeah, you're busy, man.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm afraid. I don't want to be a professional YouTuber, you know. Like, so I'm saying, I mean, one of the beauties of having different income sources and being able to still produce and play on music, if I haven't played guitar during the day, I'm getting depressed, you know.
Totally.
So one of the benefits is like, I can move around. And I also think I'm of absolutely no value to the people I talk to. If I recommend a pair of speakers or try a pair of speakers and then I don't lead them up for a few days and actually mix on them. I mean, I'm mixing on these speakers, these tiny little 5-inch speakers with these tiny little woofers. We're mixing on them at the moment. Admittedly, they're the roughs, they're not the main ones, but who knows? Sometimes my roughs beat my main mixes, you know?
Right.
And so I'm really of no use to people if I make it all, you know, turn into that professional YouTuber kind of thing. So, but you know, it's splitting my time up between millions of things. And I know during the pandemic, we weren't able to finish off some projects and stuff. And Eric said to me like a month ago, he's like, we're going to do like more like production work. And the great thing is like it opened up, you know, it definitely opened up. There was mixing stuff and mixing opportunities during the pandemic. But now, you know, people are coming back in. We went to Nashville and did some stuff a couple of weeks ago. We went to Sunset Sound a week and a half ago and recorded there. And now we're doing overdubs. We're back at Sunset Sound next week. You know, it's great. Just working.
No, it's great.
Doing it all. Doing
no, I appreciate it. It's been a real joy to talk to you. I dig the page. I watch you all the time, and it's a lot of fun. And, you know, if you can't have joy in your life, it's a pretty empty life, right? So having something that you feel passionate about and you love doing, it's totally worth it. And I appreciate it. My last question, I've got Ty Tabor coming in here in 2 days.
Wow.
To talk all about King's X. So what should I ask him?
Oh, I don't know. You know, because I was just talking about him this morning because my good friend Jamie Humphreys, if you know him as a guitar player, Ty's one of his heroes. He's a huge King's X fan. Tell Ty that I want to interview him as well.
Okay.
And that Jamie and I want to do something with him as well.
I'll do it. He lives here in Kansas City, and that's my first question because I don't know why he lives here, but I'm glad because we're going to do it in person and stuff. But I'm happy to do that, and I'll let you know, and I'll shoot you his email. So
yeah, I'm a huge fan, and I know Jamie is like a massive fan, and I think they're friends. I think Jamie and Ty speak fairly regularly, but it's interesting because Jamie Humphreys and I, we have exactly the same musical taste. Like this morning, you know, we're both huge Queen fans. Obviously he played in Brian May's band. He also played with Queen on Freddie's 75th birthday, you know, so, or 65th birthday. He played in that show. I think he's the only other guitar player that's played on stage visibly with Queen. I know that they might have somebody backstage. I don't know. But anyway, so we love all the same people. And this morning we were talking about Ty, which is really weird, Ty and Steve Morse. And I said to him, oh, I was just talking to my friend Justin, who's going to hook me up, because he works with Deep Purple. He's going to hook me up with Steve Morse. And he's like, me and Steve are great friends. I'm like, well, why are we talking to Steve Morse? So we're going to get Steve Morse.
Well, you're going to get Steve Morse. You're probably going to get Ty Tabor, because this is like in 3 days. He's actually coming to my house. I'm going to have to frantically clean, because he's got... apparently they're doing a King's X documentary. So he says, is it all right if I bring my documentarian people too? And I was like, sure. And I told the wife, I was like, we got to do a lot of cleaning before Friday. So,
oh God.
Anyway. Hey man, Warren, it's been a joy. It's been a real pleasure. I really appreciate it. I'll send you a link when it goes live and share away, man.
Absolutely. Will do.
All right, bud. Have a good night. All right. Bye.
You too. Thanks very much. Bye. Bye.
Warren Hewitt, everybody. Thanks so much to Warren. It was a lot of fun. I think I've told people this before, but if you don't know the theme song of this podcast that you're listening to right now, this was recorded at home all over the country. We had me playing guitar here in Kansas City. My sister from another Mr. Laura Ellis is singing vocals. She recorded her track in Los Angeles, and Bobby Harris did a sax part in Los Angeles, and Tyson Leslie did his keyboard parts in Nashville. He's back here in town, but back then he was still in Nashville. Go-Go Ray sat right in front of me and did a drum part on the E-Kit that I own and was fabulous. So you can have a really cool track. Oh, well, and then I had Billy Decker mix it. Sorry, folks. You got a friend, college buddy, that's a professional mixer, can make things sound awesome. Yeah, you use it. So anyway, but that's gonna do it for this time. Check in the show notes. We've got all the information for Warren. Give him a shout out. Give him a little love. He does really respond to people on YouTube. You write something like, "Hey, I really like that." He's gonna like it and respond. Nice guy. Really nice guy. So anyway, that'll do it for this time. But next time, yes, Ty Tabor of King's X came to my house. And we talked all about the new album and why he's in Kansas City and all stuff. And he brought his documentarians. It was crazy, but really cool. So I know there's a ton of King's X fans, a very, very rabid fan base of a great band. So that's next time, 1 week from today, which will be my official 2-year anniversary of the podcast. Check that out. Until then, go out, support live music, and we'll talk real soon. Bye-bye.
I might take a plane, I might take a train, but if I have to walk, I wanna get